Hello and welcome to the program. My name is Luke Hunt and this is another broadcast for the Beyond the Mekong through the Diplomat. And with me today is Will Chickering, a terrific veteran from the United States who has written a book, A War on Their Own, Full Row, The Other National Liberation Front, Vietnam, 1955-75. Will, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
It's a fascinating book that goes into the great detail about other war that was going on during the Vietnam War, mm-hmm. and Full Row, that it's the Montagnards, it's the Hill Tribes, and they loathed the Vietnamese, or they loathed all outsiders, and what they really wanted was a country of their own.
Right. Exactly. At least autonomy for their area.
And it's an issue that's parlayed all the way through till today. Just give us a quick background about the book, and then I'd really like to get into a bit more about how you came to write the book.
Okay, all right. You want me to get into the background of the book? Basically, Full Row was an ethno-nationalist organization that consisted of three groups of people that were ethnic minorities that wanted back part of Vietnam that had been lost to the Vietnamese in their eyes. That included Khmer Krom, the Khmer that lived in the Mekong Delta. That included Choms of Vietnam, who at one time had a kingdom that was ruled for 1,000 years along the coast of Vietnam, but also in the highlands, perhaps. I say that because I personally think they never colonized the highlands. And the reason that Full Row sprang up was because the Montagnard people living in the highlands had never been dominated. They had never been colonized. And the only time they started to be dominated was when quinine arrived in 1885, and malaria and lowlanders were able to step onto the highlands without catching malaria. My connection in my mind is that basically the Montagnards were protected by malaria from colonization, and this gave them a sense of freedom and lack of domination that some 80 years later, 70 years later, showed up as Full Row. So that's kind of circuitous way of saying that Full Row sprang up in the mid-1950s because the Montagnards had known freedom, and it was only one or two generations prior. And then when Diem settled 140,000 North Vietnamese colonists in the highlands following the partition of Vietnam, they rose up in anger at the sight of their cemeteries being bulldozed and at the fact of their lands being taken by Vietnamese. And at that point, ethno-nationalism developed, and that was the seed of Full Row. But I prefer to think of the seeds having been planted back 80 years before, when the Montagnards still knew freedom and still had complete control and sovereignty over their lands.
The history of the Montagnards and the Viets and the Chinese, it goes back a long way.
It does, absolutely. Sometime in 1200, Kublai Khan invaded Champa, somewhere near Quy Nhon. And the reason was because he had just taken over China, and he was unhappy that the Choms were not sending ambassadors to kowtow to him. So he sent an invading army, and the Choms met this invading army on the plains near Quy Nhon, eventually lost, and the Chom king had to retreat into the mountains with his son. He took refuge in part of the highlands that's it's very close to Ban Don, if anybody knows where that is. It's in an area that's very dry. And later he erected a temple there. So that's how we know he took refuge there. The point is that the Montagnards and the Choms supported each other for the next 800 years. Generally the Choms would sometimes intermarry with the Montagnards. There were a couple of Chom kings that probably were Rade, and there was a close relationship between Rade and certainly Jirai and Choms for 800 years. Fast forward to May 5th and 6th, 1970, Full Row, consisting of 200 Montagnards and 50 Chom, are in Sim Mon Rom when the North Vietnamese decide to try to take the town. as part of generally sweeping through Mondulkiri after the incursion by the Americans. They fought, this group of 250 and some Khmer soldiers, fought on top of the mountain that is visible there in Semonaram for one night successfully, and then the second night they began to get the feeling that this next assault by the North Vietnamese seasoned troops was going to be the end, and so they had to escape and evade, and they successfully did so across all of Cambodia to Krache and then south to Snul. But it hit me that this battle on the mountain right next to Semonaram was basically the last stand of an 800-year-old alliance between Cham's and Montagnards against the southward movement of the Vietnamese. And I think it deserves some sort of memorial for that reason. The Phu Rho's stand with the Cham was the last stand against the Vietnamese. I don't think it's gonna happen again.
Right, I mean, of course, we're speaking as the 50th anniversary of the end of Vietnam War, Second Indochina War, 1975 is approaching. And of course, Hanoi is quick to promote everything to do with that era as a war of nationalism. Right. But when you look at the French, I think the French did a reasonable job in terms of dividing Indochina up by geographic borders and and even ethnicity, in that you had Kampuchea Krom, which was southern Vietnam, which was Cochin China. You had these Montagnard areas, and to claim this was all a war of liberation based on Viet nationalism, it's a long stretch.
You're talking about the nationalism of the Montagnards, the nationalism of the Vietnamese?
The Vietnamese.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, I think if I understood your question correctly, it was certainly they were fighting a war to regain their entire country from what they saw as usurpers and invaders, the American particularly. But the point about Phu Rho is that Phu Rho felt exactly the same way about the Highlands. They saw the Vietnamese, both communist and non-communist, as usurpers, as invaders of their land, and they saw themselves, the Phu Rho Montagnards, saw themselves as anti-colonial revolutionaries in the same way that the Vietnamese had been anti-colonial revolutionaries against the French. And in fact, they saw themselves so much as revolutionaries that they addressed each other as frère instead of comrade. They spoke of oaths on the revolutionary flag. They imitated a lot of Viet Cong organizing tactics. And to them, this was existential kind of conflict for them, as it was for the Vietnamese fighting against the Americans in the Highlands to expel them. And there's some irony here, because obviously the larger war is framed by most of the world now as having been a war of liberation by the Vietnamese, but in fact this Phu Rho was fighting against domination and colonialism by the lowlander Vietnamese.
Right. How did you get to Vietnam in the first place? As I understand it, you dropped out of Yale as a university student, wanting to see the world. 1963,
that's right.
You became a paratrooper with the US military. And then it was, take us through.
Yeah, that's right. The world was very different, obviously, in 1963. I really didn't think about Vietnam when I joined up. But by the time my tour was finished, I had a two-year tour in order to get into the paratroops. Actually, it was free to get into the paratroops. I had to commit for that. By the time I was approaching the end of that, I had gone to Officers Kennedy School, and the Vietnam War had heated up, and I had ended up going to Special Warfare School, which is school to become a Green Beret, and my own attitudes had changed. I felt that we were doing the right thing to try to help South Vietnam to defend itself against subversion from the North. And so willingly went to South Vietnam, although with a 8-month stop in Okinawa first, which was sort of obligatory at that time. It was still so early that most special forces soldiers went to Oki first and then went to South Vietnam. Mm-hmm. But I showed up in South Vietnam in September of 1966. My first tour there was in a camp high in the mountains of I Corps, where basically we were wet all the time and I didn't see any enemy. I just got shot at and that was it. The second part of my tour, the last 8 months, I was commander of a battalion of Montagnards in a recon unit that was situated on the border, although we did the recon on the Vietnam side of the border, not in Cambodia. And because by chance my troops had zero Vietnamese in the unit, this attracted all the firebrand Montagnards who did not like the Vietnamese, and that by definition were Foro members. And I became intrigued by Foro because these guys would whisper with nods to the west across the border about this thing called Foro that got them very excited. And then gradually I got the idea that Foro was based in Cambodia and that its leaders were in Phnom Penh. So 6 years later, after I'd gone back to college and after I'd gotten out of the army, and I had a chance in 1973 because of the Paris Peace Accords to come back, I came back to the Vietnam Highlands and then I came back to Phnom Penh, or came to Phnom Penh for the first time in 1973 to meet the leaders of Foro. And I did, and there were four Montagnards. There had been another one who had been mysteriously murdered, but there were four Montagnards still alive. Of those four, three ended up 2 years later in the French embassy where they had to, where they were pressured to leave and disappear.
This was at April 17, 1975, exactly. As Pol Pot was leading the troops into Phnom Penh.
Right, exactly. Okay. Yep. So three of these guys that I met in 73, all of the Montagnards ended up in the hands of the Khmer Rouge and disappeared forever on April 21st, 1975. Mm-hmm. They were part of the group of Asians that were, pressured to leave. I've been told not to use the word expelled, and that's probably true.
That they were it's a little bit like we're in Cambodia now. They don't like it when you describe the Vietnamese invasion that ousted the Khmer Rouge. Yeah. They don't like it being described as an invasion. They prefer military incursion that was led by Khmer Rouge defectors. Right. However, there were 150,000 Vietnamese troops coming in and they stormed the beaches at Sihanoukville. So it's a bit, I'm sorry, but it is what it is.
I avoid the word invasion simply because it only went 30 kilometers across the border, and so therefore. I know what you're saying.
We're at the French embassy.
Okay,
April,
so the French embassy. So they were pressured to leave and disappeared. Three of these guys. Yep. Okay, there was a fourth Montagnard leader who happened to be at Fort Benning taking military training during the fall of Phnom Penh. His family was still in Phnom Penh and in the French embassy, but he was at Fort Benning. And in June of 1975, I got a call from him. I was in medical school at the time, and I got a call from him saying, hey, I met you 2 years ago. I'm now a refugee. What do I do? And he and I became friends, and I mentored him for about a number of years until he had made enough money working in coke plants and tire plants and that sort of thing to go out into the world on his own and see if he could figure out what had happened to his family. And he disappeared in 1986, and I thought that was it. I was never going to think about Foro again. And then in 2008, 22 years later, I got an email from an anthropologist in Bon Lung, in the highlands of Cambodia, saying there's this guy that wants to talk to you. And it turned out to be my friend named Bon, B-H-A-N, who was the fourth Montagnard leader. And he entered my life to the extent that he became like an exotic uncle to my children. We ended up moving to Phnom Penh from Beijing, where I was working as a doc. I would commute back and forth to Beijing to keep working, but most of the time I was here in Phnom Penh, learning that the Foro story is also a Cambodia story.
Sure.
And, I had more information than I knew what to do with. The parents of my children at the Lycée Descartes all had somebody they had lost to the Khmer Rouge, and many had someone who had been in the embassy. and either pressured to leave or actually got back to France because they had some sort of connection with France. So that is the backstory. Obviously, from what became an interest in Bond's own biography, turned into an interest in Furo itself, but one that I couldn't finish. I couldn't finish the story of Furo until the woman who was the wife of a Cham colonel that had been a very important person, a liaison certainly between Sihanouk and Furo and possibly a puppet master, although I don't think so. His widow gave me access to his secret papers in 2018, and mm-hmm. suddenly that enabled me to finish the book. Suddenly that made me into an expert, if one can be, about a dead, lost movement that disappeared 20 years ago or 40 years ago, actually 50 years ago, right? And then it took me the rest of the time to produce the book.
50 years after 75 and the capitulation of Indochina to communism, it's quite interesting the amount of books that are coming out all these years later that have the details of what happened all those years ago.
I'm fascinated.
You're not the only author.
I'm not aware of any. Name some for me. I know the ones that came out in the 90s that were sort of re-looking at it politically and saying, hey, wait a minute, maybe it wasn't a mistake. Maybe, the Americans were doing the right thing, et cetera, et cetera. And there was sort of revisionist history mm-hmm. that way. I didn't realize, and maybe I'm trying to stake out a special little place for
me.
I didn't realize that anybody had access to information that was fresh and new and yet completely unknown from back then, which is really what this book is.
Yeah, well, it's certainly concerning Furo, yes.
Yeah.
And I think it's happening across the spectrum when it comes to the Vietnam War. I mean, there's been quite a few books have been published. There were three published in English in regards to the Vietnamese invasion of Cambodia.
Okay.
There have been books written about Air America, books written by former servicemen who said, this is what happened.
Right.
This is how we escaped. These were the operations that were conducted out of, Thailand in terms of incursions into Laos post-75.
I see. So basically U.S. servicemen that are basically telling their stories in detail. Anything from CIA? Anything from... Because I really ran into a brick wall with the CIA. So much so that I wonder if part of the reason is that they, A, didn't know what was going on inside Furo, B, did know what was going on in South Vietnam in relation to Furo, but that they were embarrassed and or responsible possibly for an assassination within Cambodia itself. In other words, I don't understand the CIA's inability to open up to me now 60 years later, when they can all sign a piece of paper asking for permission from the CIA, and the CIA will give it to them. So the CIA has been like a tomb, no secrets coming out from them. And then, somewhat almost amusingly, in 2023, Macron decided to extend the French blackout time from the standard 60 years to 70. Mm-hmm. So suddenly the secret service files of France have been blacked out from 1963 to 1973. In other words, the entire Vietnam War is now suddenly off bounds from the point of view of what the French Secret Service did.
Well, I think with regards to the CIA, a lot of it's just their culture. I did write to them in regards to Pham Suan, who was the great Vietnamese spy many years ago, asking for confirmation. Did he work for the CIA? People have suggested he was a double agent. The way I understand it, I'm entitled to access this kind of information, but the response was what you would expect. Dear sir, thank you for your inquiry. We will be looking into this, notify you further, something along those lines.
But it was basically
just a stalling tactic, and I've often found that that's often what comes out of not just the CIA, say a spook agency, but also anything out of the institutions and bureaucracies.
Well, yeah, that's a good point. I submitted a Freedom of Information Act in 8 years ago.
Right.
And now it doesn't even show up on the website anymore. It's disappeared. They've lost it. And yet there's guys out there or women out there that are writing stories that clearly have been sourced from CIA people. And so how does one reach those folks? I don't know.
I think personally is the only way.
Yeah, right.
Personal contacts outside that, they don't give you much.
Right, and that's what I was hoping for out of the FCC last night. I was hoping that somebody would say, I can help you. But no. At this point, the book's written. I stand by it because I personally think, and this is an important point, the Montagnards knew that they were being manipulated, not just by their enemies being all Vietnamese, both communists and non-communists, but by their friends. They knew that. They knew that the Americans wanted something from them, that the French wanted something from them. The French probably got there first, in the sense that the French saw early on that one way to cause problems for the Americans and the South Vietnamese was to be a thorn in their side and to cause problems for that alliance. And to that extent, they convinced the Montagnards to put on a very bloody rebellion in September 1964, which really was a problem for the alliance. The Vietnamese were very angry, wanted to crush the Montagnards. The Americans had to hold them off and say, no, no, don't, please. And so the French had a very obvious motive in trying to energize Faureau and midwife it. I don't believe they parented Faureau. I think it was truly a Montagnard organization. But did they midwife its birth in the 50s? Yeah, I think they did. The Americans, to my guess, because of course I haven't talked with anybody, but the Americans probably were trying to reduce the French actions. Anything that the French wanted was something the Americans probably didn't, because the Americans wanted Faureau to be more moderate. The Americans didn't want revolutionaries across the border and causing problems for Saigon. They wanted the Montagnard leaders, both in South Vietnam and across the border, and Faureau to be willing to negotiate with Saigon, to be willing to try to make the lives of Montagnards better within South Vietnam,
right.
And which it makes perfect sense given the war aims of the United States. But it was very different from what the French wanted. I don't know, but I think there was one French, very pro-French Montagnard leader, the fifth one that disappeared, that may have been assassinated at the urging, I don't think caused by the CIA, but I could imagine that he was viewed as someone that was not helping and was turning the Faureau into a more aggressive, more dangerous organization than America wanted.
Okay, I realize your book has its written in history, but over the last few years, we've seen uprisings by the Montagnards again in those Hill Tribe areas. There was a 100-odd sentence last year for what happened in July the year before, where 20-odd were killed again.
Right.
Antique shotguns, spears, bows and arrows
were again deployed. I missed that about 100. I know about the one two years ago.
Yeah, and stemming from that, the uprising 2 years ago, I think there were about 100 people have been jailed by the Vietnamese. It's an issue that hasn't really gone away. One reference point we have consistently to this day with the Montagnards is religion.
Yes. And evangelical Protestantism. Exactly.
Yeah. How important was that back then in the 50s?
I think both the Protestants and the Catholics have been missionaries around Bonnie Tuit since the mid-30s.
Right.
And they had converted a fair number of Rade Montagnards. The Jirai were not as converted to Christianity. Then my impression is that during the Vietnam War, during the post-1975 period after the war, the Protestant religion was able to take off in a way that Catholic was not,
right?
Because the Catholics require priests and all that, whereas the Protestants, all the guy needed was a Bible to call himself a pastor, and they'd have house churches, and it spread like wildfire. No,
a lot of the Catholicism had initially come with the French Jesuits a lot earlier. The Protestantism, I keep seeing references to radio broadcasts.
Out of Philippines.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, they don't have to go to church. They're just sitting back listening to a Sunday broadcast.
And You're absolutely right. Yeah, maybe those Philippine broadcasts were hugely important in terms of keeping the flame alive during the period of time that the Montagnards, a lot of them, most of them, didn't have any other form of resistance other than to grab a hold of something that was not Vietnamese, and different form of identity that was not Vietnamese. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, ironically, it's this cultural import called Christianity, but that a lot of them grabbed a hold of this as a way of differentiating themselves mm-hmm. from the Vietnamese that wanted to turn them into Vietnamese. And that's one of the things that Fulro was very clear about in the beginning.
Right.
And their manifesto actually was very clearly written, said, we don't want to turn into Vietnamese. That is one of the reasons for Fulro, is not to become Vietnamese.
How do you, in the fullness of time, for want of a better cliche, in the fullness of time, 50 years after 1975, when you look back and you look at America's involvement in the Vietnam War, your own efforts in writing, and I must quickly add that this book is getting terrific reviews. Michael Hayes, the Southeast Asian critic, shall we call you, he gave you a terrific write-up. When you look back over the last 50 years and what has happened in Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos, I guess, as well, how do you view the American war, as Hanoi would phrase it?
I think, you know, I've been anticipating and hearing that question off and on for years, and then I must admit I haven't always been consistent in how I answer it. But the simplest answer, and it's almost too simple, is that Cambodia and the experience of the Khmer Rouge, I think, was an inherent problem within communism, an inherent problem within Asian communism, maybe communism in general. I just don't know about the others. And it could have happened in Vietnam. Why it didn't, I don't know. I know there's plenty of good guy communists in Vietnam and all that sort of stuff. But to me, when I was in Okinawa in 1965 and about to go to Vietnam, I could hear Radio Peking and, you know, the choir singing "The East is Red" with this incredible enthusiasm and booming voices. And it made me worried. It made me afraid for the world that this kind of insanity that was part of the communist religion could end up killing a lot of people. And okay, I was wrong about Vietnam, or sort of. I was certainly right about Cambodia.
Sure.
So that's the way I answer that question. I recognize it's an oversimplification.
The experiences between Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos were very different. And in Cambodia, the Khmer Rouge applied the tenets of communism 100%.
Right.
Where in Vietnam, I'm reluctant to say they were a little more relaxed, because communism, as far as I'm concerned, and the way it was imposed, was dreadful. Mm-hmm. However, they did not nationalize every potato, every rock, every, you know, every doorknob, like the Khmer Rouge did. We own everything. And the Vietnamese did tolerate religion, even some forms of basic capitalism,
right,
which here in Cambodia was a complete anathema.
Right.
And
yeah, a very big point to me was that, having worked with CIDG, the irregular soldiers that were recruited, trained, armed, and paid by Americans to work in the U.S. Special Forces camps. Having worked with CIDG, and also having seen them and heard about them in some very, very dangerous missions, I should say heard about them in dangerous missions. My missions were relatively mild.
Right.
But having heard about what they risked working with the Americans, I found it difficult to believe that mercenaries, the phrase that was bandied about by the communists, of course, as a form of propaganda to discredit the CIDG, I found it, and unfortunately was picked up by the international press. The international press used that word a lot, unthinkingly. That pissed me off, and it didn't strike me as real. And one of the things that I found, and I'm 95% certain of this, and I have some indirect statements that it's true, is that in Mundukiri, where Fulro troops, its army, took refuge after having rebelled bloodily in 1964 against the Vietnamese, Mundukiri was a refuge handed to them by Sihanouk. He also gave Mondelkiri to the NVA and the VC. And he said to all three, you guys need to stay apart. So basically, Fulro had nobody to fight within Mondelkiri. For various reasons, there was not very much in the way of South Vietnamese military along the border of Mondelkiri, so very little sort of raids they could do against South Vietnamese soldiers. And so I think somebody in Fulro realized quite early, like as early as 62, that the way they were going to get arms, the way they were going to get ammunition, was by signing up to work with the Americans and pilfer the ammo dumps, which I let them do. And more importantly, the way they were going to get combat training and combat experience and combat training with new weapons like claymores, the only way they were going to do that was with the Americans. And so what happened is that Fulro sent its young men, its young soldiers that needed to be turned into soldiers to eventually fight the Vietnamese whenever the Great Armageddon took place, they sent them to join the CIDG, and they were not mercenaries. They were there at worst with two motives. You know, the paycheck was nice, but they also were there for a higher motive, which was Fulro. And at the height, I have evidence that there were 15 to 20,000 CIDG that were Fulro members. And
a significant number.
A significant number. And at the height, there were 5,000 to 6,000 soldiers in Mondelkiri that were part of Fulro, and with 15,000 dependents. Now imagine that. We were totally unaware of that. We were totally unaware that it was as numerically as large a phenomenon, and evidently in terms of allegiance and heart, as large a phenomenon as it was.
Yeah, I do think the role of Prince Norodom Sihanouk back then has been woefully underplayed over the years. I mean, we do know that he was an instigator in establishing the Ho Chi Minh Trail in the early 60s and was taking a cut off weapons deals. That goes back to 1962. We do know that he gave the Americans permission to come over the border to conduct to conduct raids on communist holdouts, as opposed to it being a full-scale invasion. We also know that he knew about the American bombings. And the American bombings, which there's a lot of myths about this, but they did kill 50,000, not 500,000 or 250,000. And they were targeting the communists. They were targeting the Khmer Rouge, who would take over Cambodia and commit a great genocide and wipe out a third of their own population. So it's a...
You missed the Sihanoukville Trail, which was the other thing from Sihanouk, by Sihanouk, from 1966 to 1970 when Sihanouk was deposed, delivered an enormous amount of arms. Although I just heard recently somebody think that too is not the figure is not as great as it seemed, but there's no question there was a lot of arms delivered that way. From the point of view of Fulro, though, sure, Sihanouk wanted Fulro to be a thorn in the side of the Vietnamese, the same as the French. Sihanouk and the French were you know, buddies.
Yeah, they're all friends.
And he suggested that Fulro be formed first as in 1960, as a front for the liberation of Champa, the country of the Chams. And this is taken as evidence that he started Fulro. However, I know very well the man who was this supposed puppet master of Fulro, a Cham from near Kompong Cham in Cambodia. At age 13, he was dreaming of reviving the country of Champa, the empire of Champa. He needed no pushing by Sihanouk to start this front for the liberation of Champa. So, is it still going? So basically, my take on what happened between Fulro and the French, and Fulro and the Americans, and Fulro and particularly Sihanouk representing the French, but his intermediary, the Cham, is that their relationships were transactional. If the French could help them get this autonomy by increasing their violence and increasing their effect on the South Vietnamese, they were happy to do what the French wanted. But I think they were well aware that they were being manipulated. I think that they saw what they wanted. And so, yes, Sihanouk was hugely important to Fulro. But I think it's because what he wanted fit with what they wanted up until the point where they started joining the CIDG, right. Okay? That cannot have pleased the French. The French must have been very unhappy when all these Montagnard soldiers started joining the CIDG and fighting the communists on behalf of the American Green Berets.
And of course, Sedlec would be ousted by a vote in Parliament, and instead of going to Paris, as many thought he would, he went to Beijing and urged everybody to join the Khmer Rouge.
Yeah, right.
There's a hell of a twist in history. Will Chickering, author of A War of Their Own, what's next? Researching another book?
That's a good question. My wife and I are thinking of writing a book about our relationship, and that's certainly going to take some time. Mm-hmm. And then maybe a little bit more to the point here. Mm-hmm. This story is like the proverbial elephant, okay, where you've got people that know a little bit of what the elephant feels like, the blind man. I think there's 1,000 blind men out there that know something about this story, and I need to know what they know. And so I've put in the book an email by which I can be reached, and hopefully I'll get more information, including from the Secret Services, mm-hmm. and be able to write a second book.
Perhaps, or a second edition, I guess.
Right, a second edition, claiming that it was the first one was perfect.
It's been done before.
Yeah.
Will Chickering, it's been a delightful chat. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Luke.
Cheers.
Nice to see you, Ray. Cheers.